cunning fellow, that Caderousse. There, you are beginning again to ramble, to talk again and again of the past. But what is the use of teasing me with so much repetition? Ah, you are only 1 in 20 and can forget the past. I am 50 and am obliged to recollect it. But let us return to business. Yes, I was going to say, if I were in your place, well, I would realize. How would you realize? I would ask for 6 months in advance, under pretense of being able to purchase a farm. Then, with my 6 months, I would decamp. Well, well, said Andrea. That is no bad thought, my dear friend, said Caderousse. Eat of my bread, and take my advice. You will be none the worse off, physically or morally. But, said Andrea, why do you not act on the advice you give me? Why do you not realize a 6 months, a year's advance even, and retire to Brussels? Instead of living the retired baker, you might live as a bankrupt, using his privileges. That would be very good. But how the devil would you have me retire on 1,200 francs? Ah, Caderousse, said Andrea, how covetous you are. 2 months since you were dying with hunger. In eating, the appetite grows, said Caderousse, grinning, and showing his teeth like a monkey laughing or a tiger growling. And, added he, biting off with those large white teeth an enormous mouthful of bread, I have formed a plan. Caderousse's plans alarmed Andrea still more than his ideas. Ideas were but the germ. The plan was reality. Let me see your plan. I dare say it is a pretty one. Why not? Who formed the plan by which we left the establishment of Monsieur, eh? Was it not I? And it was no bad one, I believe, since here we are.
I do not say, replied Andrea, that you never make a good one. But let us see your plan.
Well, pursued Caderousse, can you, without expending one sou, put me in the way of getting 15,000 francs? No, 15,000 are not enough. I cannot again become an honest man with less than 30,000 francs.
No, replied Andrea dryly. No, I cannot.
I do not think you understand me, replied Caderousse calmly. I said, without your laying out a sou.
Do you want me to commit a robbery, to spoil all my good fortune, and yours with mine, and both of us to be dragged down there again?
It would make very little difference to me, said Caderousse, if I were retaken. I am a poor creature to live alone, and sometimes pine for my old comrades. Not like you, heartless creature, who would be glad never to see them again.
Andrea did more than tremble this time. He turned pale. Come, Caderousse, no nonsense, said he.
Don't alarm yourself, my little Benedetto, but just point out to me some means of gaining those 30,000 francs without your assistance, and I will contrive it.
Well, I will see. I will recollect you, said Andrea.
Meanwhile, you will raise my month to 500 francs, my little fellow. I have a fancy and mean to get a housekeeper.
Well, you shall have your 500 francs, said Andrea. But it is very hard for me, my poor Caderousse. You take advantage.
Bah! Said Caderousse, when you have access to countless stores.
One would have said that Andrea anticipated his companion's words, so did his eye flash like lightning, but it was but for a moment.
True, he replied, and my protector is very kind. That dear protector, said Caderousse,
And how much does he give you monthly? 5,000 francs. As many thousands as you give me hundreds. Truly, it is only bastards who are thus fortunate. 5,000 francs per month. What the devil can you do with all that?
Oh, it is no trouble to spend that. And I am like you. I want a capital.
A capital, yes, I understand. Everyone would like a capital.
Well, and I shall get one.
Who will give it to you? Your prince?
Yes, my prince. But unfortunately, I must wait.
You must wait for what?
Said Caderousse. For his death.
The death of your prince?
Yes.
How so?
Because he has made his will in my favour.
Indeed, on my honour. For how much?
For 500,000.
Only that? It's little enough.
But so it is.
No, it cannot be.
Are you my friend, Caderousse?
Yes, in life or death.
Well, I will tell you a secret.
What is it?
But remember,
pardieu, mute as a carp.
Well, I think... Andrea stopped and looked around him.
You think? Do not fear, pardieu, we are alone.
I think I have discovered my father.
Your true father?
Yes. Not old Cavalcanti? No, for he has gone again. The true one, as you say.
And that father is?
Well, Caderousse, it is Monte Cristo.
Bah!
Yes, you understand. That explains all. He cannot acknowledge me openly, it appears, but he does it through Monsieur Cavalcanti and gives him 50,000 francs for it.
50,000 francs for being your father? I would have done it for half that, for 20,000, for 15,000. Why did you not think of me, ungrateful man? Did I know anything about it when it was all done, when I was down there? Ah, truly. And you say that by his will he leaves me 500,000 livres. Are you sure of it?
He showed it me. But that is not all. There is a codicil, as I said just now.
Probably.
And in that codicil, he acknowledges me.
Oh, the good father, the brave father, the very honest father, said Caderousse, twirling a plate in the air between his two hands.
Now say if I conceal anything from you.
No, and your confidence makes you honourable, in my opinion. And your princely father, is he rich, very rich?
Yes, in truth. He does not himself know the amount of his fortune.
Is it possible?
It is evident enough to me, who am always at his house. The other day, a banker's clerk brought him 50,000 francs in a portfolio about the size of your plate. Yesterday, his banker brought him 100,000 francs in gold. Caderousse was filled with wonder. The young man's words sounded to him like metal, and he thought he could hear the rushing of cascades of louis.
"And you go into that house?"
cried he briskly. "When I like." Caderousse was thoughtful for a moment. It was easy to perceive he was revolving some important idea in his mind. Then, suddenly,
"How I should like to see all that," cried he. "How beautiful it must be."
"It is, in fact, magnificent," said Andrea.
"And does he not live in the Champs-Élysées?"
"Yes, number 30.
"Ah," said Caderousse, "number 30.
"Yes, a fine house, standing alone, between a courtyard and a garden. You must know it."
"Possibly. But it is not the exterior I care for. It is the interior. What beautiful furniture there must be in it. Have you ever seen the Tuileries?
No.
Well, it surpasses that. It must be worth one's while to stoop, Andrea, when that good Monsieur Monte Cristo lets fall his purse.
It is not worth while to wait for that, said Andrea. Money is as plentiful in that house as fruit in an orchard.
But you should take me there one day with you.
How can I? On what plea?
You are right. But you have made my mouth water. I must absolutely see it. I shall find a way.
No nonsense, Caderousse. I will offer myself as a frotteur.
The rooms are all carpeted.
Well, then, I must be contented to imagine it.
That is the best plan, believe me. Try, at least, to give me an idea of what it is.
How can I?
Nothing is easier.
Is it large?
Middling.
How is it arranged?
Faith, I should require pen, ink, and paper to make a plan.
They are all here, said Caderousse briskly.
He fetched from an old secretaire a sheet of white paper and pen and ink.
Here, said Caderousse, trace me all that on paper, my boy.
Andrea took the pen with an imperceptible smile and began, The house, as I said, is between the court and the garden. In this way, do you see?
Andrea traced the garden, the court, and the house.
High walls?
No more than 8 or 10 feet.
That is not prudent, said Caderousse.
In the court are orange trees in pots, turf, and clumps of flowers.
And no steel traps?
No.
The stables are on either side of the gate which you see there.
And Andrea continued his plan.
Let us see the ground floor, said Caderousse.
On the ground floor, dining room, 2 drawing rooms, billiard room, staircase in the hall, and little back staircase.
Windows, magnificent windows, so beautiful, so large, that I believe a man of your size could pass through each frame.
Why the devil have they any stairs with such windows?
Luxury has everything.
But shutters?
Yes, but they are never used. That Count of Monte Cristo is an original who loves to look at the sky, even at night.
And where do the servants sleep?
Oh, they have a house to themselves. Picture to yourself a pretty coach house at the right-hand side where the ladders are kept.
Well, over that coach house are the servants' rooms, with bells corresponding with the different apartments.
Ah, diable. Bells, did you say?
What do you mean?
Oh, nothing. I only say they cost a load of money to hang. And what is the use of them, I should like to know?
There used to be a dog let loose in the yard at night, but it has been taken to the house at Auteuil, to that you went to, you know.
Yes.
I was saying to him only yesterday, you are imprudent, Monsieur le Comte, for when you go to Auteuil and take your servants, the house is left unprotected.
Well, he said, what next?
Well, next, some day you will be robbed.
What did he answer?
He quietly said, What do I care if I am?
Andrea, he has some secretaire with a spring.
How do you know?
Yes, which catches the thief in a trap and plays a tune. I was told there was such at the last exit.
Simply a mahogany secretaire in which the key is always kept.
And he is not robbed?
No. His servants are all devoted to him.
There ought to be some money in that secretaire.
There may be. No one knows what there is.
And where is it?
On the first floor.
Sketch me the plan of that floor, as you have done of the ground floor, my boy.
That is very simple.
Andrea took the pen. On the first story, do you see, there is the anteroom and drawing room. To the right of the drawing room, a library and a study. To the left, a bedroom and a dressing room. The famous secretaire is in the dressing room. Is there a window in the dressing room? Two, one here and one there. Andrea sketched two windows in the room, which formed an angle on the plan, and appeared a smaller square added to the long square of the bedroom. Caderousse became thoughtful.
"Does he often go to Auteuil?" added he.
"Two or three times a week. Tomorrow, for instance, he is going to spend the day and night there."
"Are you sure of it? He has invited me to dine there." "There is a life, for instance," said Caderousse. "A town house and a country house.
That is what it is to be rich."
"And shall you dine there?"
"Probably."
"When you dine there, do you sleep there?"
"If I like. I am at home there." Caderousse looked at the young man as if to get at the truth from the bottom of his heart. But Andrea drew a cigar case from his pocket, took a Havana, quietly lit it, and began smoking. "When do you want your 500 francs?" said he to Caderousse.
"Now, if you have them."
Andrea took 25 louis from his pocket.
"Yellow boys," said Caderousse. "No, I thank you."
"Oh, you despise them?"
"On the contrary, I esteem them, but will not have them."
"You can change them, idiot. Gold is worth 5 sous.
"Exactly. And he who changes them will follow friend Caderousse, lay hands on him, and demand what farmers pay him their rent in gold." "No nonsense, my good fellow. Silver, simply. Round coins with the head of some monarch or other on them. Anybody may possess a 5-franc piece.
"But do you suppose I carry 500 francs about with me? I should want a porter."
"Well, leave them with your porter. He is to be trusted. I will call for them."
"Today?"
"No, tomorrow. I shall not have time today."
"Well, tomorrow I will leave them when I go to Auteuil.
May I depend on it?"
"Certainly."
"Because I shall secure my housekeeper on the strength of it."
"Stop. Will that be all, eh? And will you not torment me any more?"
"Never."
Caderousse had become so gloomy that Andrea feared he should be obliged to notice the change. He redoubled his gaiety and carelessness.
"How sprightly you are," said Caderousse. "One would say you were already in possession of your property."
"No, unfortunately. But when I do obtain it..."
"Well?"
"I shall remember old friends. I only tell you that."
"Yes, since you have such a good memory."
"What do you want? I believe you wish to impose upon me."
"I? What an idea. I, who am going to give you another piece of good advice?"
"What is it?"
"To leave behind you the diamond you have on your finger. We shall both get in trouble. You will ruin both yourself and me by your folly."
"How so?" said Andrea.
"How? You put on livery, you disguise yourself as a servant, and yet keep a diamond on your finger worth 4 or 5 thousand francs.
"You guess well.
I know something of diamonds. I have had some."
"You do well to boast of it," said Andrea, who, without becoming angry, as Caderousse feared, at this new extortion, quietly resigned the ring. Caderousse looked so closely at it that Andrea well knew that he was examining if all the edges were perfect.
"It is a false diamond," said Caderousse.
"You are joking now," replied Andrea.
"Do not be angry. We can try it."
Caderousse went to the window, touched the glass with it, and found it would cut.
"Confiteor," said Caderousse, putting the diamond on his little finger. "I was mistaken. But those thieves of jewellers imitate so well that it is no longer worth while to rob a jeweller's shop. It is another branch of industry paralysed."
"Have you finished now?" said Andrea. "Do you want anything more? Will you have my waistcoat or my certificate? Make free, now you have begun."
"No. You are, after all, a good companion. I will not detain you, and will try to cure myself of my ambition."
"But take care the same thing does not happen to you in selling the diamond you feared with the gold."
"I shall not sell it. Do not fear it."
"Not at least till the day after tomorrow," thought the young man.
"Happy rogue," said Caderousse. "You are going to find your servants, your horses, your carriage, and your betrothed."
"Yes," said Andrea.
"Well, I hope you will make me a handsome wedding present the day you marry Mademoiselle Danglars.
I have already told you, it is a fancy you have taken in your head."
"What fortune has she? But I tell you, a million."
Andrea shrugged up his shoulders.
"Let it be a million," said Caderousse. "You can never have so much as I wish you."
"Thank you," said the young man.
"Oh, I wish it you with all my heart," added Caderousse with his hoarse laugh. "Stop. Let me show you the way."
"It is not worth while."
"Yes, it is." "Why?" "Because there is a little secret, a precaution I thought it desirable to take, one of Huret and Fichet's locks, revised and improved by Gaspard Caderousse. I will manufacture you a similar one when you are a capitalist."
"Thank you," said Andrea. "I will let you know a week beforehand." They parted. Caderousse remained on the landing until he had not only seen Andrea go down the three stories, but also cross the court. Then he returned hastily, shut his door carefully, and began to study, like a clever architect, the plan Andrea had left him.
"Dear Benedetto," said he, "I think he will not be sorry to inherit his fortune, and he who hastens the day when he can touch his 500,000 will not be his worst friend."
83. The Burglary. The day following that on which the conversation we have related took place, the Count of Monte Cristo set out for Auteuil, accompanied by Ali and several attendants, and also taking with him some horses whose qualities he was desirous of ascertaining. He was induced to undertake this journey, of which the day before he had not even thought, and which had not either occurred to Andrea, by the arrival of Bertuccio from Normandy, with intelligence respecting the house and sloop. The house was ready, and the sloop, which had arrived a week before, lay at anchor in a small creek, with her crew of 6 men who, after having observed all the requisite formalities, were ready again to put to sea. The Count praised Bertuccio's zeal, and ordered him to prepare for a speedy departure, as his stay in France would not be prolonged more than a month. "Now," said he, "I may require to go in one night from Paris to Tréport. Let 8 fresh horses be in readiness on the road, which will enable me to go 50 leagues in 10 hours. "Your Highness has already expressed that wish," said Bertuccio, "and the horses are ready. I have bought them and stationed them myself at the most desirable posts, namely in villages where no one generally stops."
"That's well," said Monte Cristo. "I remain here a day or two. Arrange accordingly." As Bertuccio was leaving the room to give the requisite orders, Battistin opened the door. He held a letter on a silver waiter. "What do you do here?" asked the Count, seeing him covered with dust. I did not send for you, I think." Batista, without answering, approached the Count and presented the letter. "Important and urgent," said he. The Count opened the letter and read, "Monsieur de Monte Cristo is apprised that this night a man will enter his house in the Champs-Élysées with intention of carrying off some papers supposed to be in the secrétaire in the dressing-room. The Count's well-known courage will render unnecessary the aid of the police, whose interference might seriously affect him who sends this advice. The Count, by any opening from the bedroom or by concealing himself in the dressing-room, would be able to defend his property himself. Many attendants or apparent precautions would prevent the villain from the attempt, and Monsieur de Monte Cristo would lose the opportunity of discovering an enemy whom chance has revealed to him who now sends this warning to the Count, a warning he might not be able to send another time if this first attempt should fail and another be made." The Count's first idea was that this was an artifice, a gross deception to draw his attention from a minor danger in order to expose him to a greater. He was on the point of sending the letter to the commissary of police, notwithstanding the advice of his anonymous friend, or perhaps because of that advice, when suddenly the idea occurred to him that it might be some personal enemy whom he alone should recognize, and over whom, if such were the case, he alone could gain any advantage. "They do not want my papers," said Monte Cristo. "They want to kill me. They are no robbers, but assassins. I will not allow the police to interfere with my private affairs." The Count recalled Batista, who had left the room after delivering the letter. "Return to Paris," said he. "Assemble the servants who remain there. I want all my household at Auteuil." "But will no one remain in the house, my lord?" asked Batista. "Yes, the porter. My lord will remember that the lodge is at a distance from the house." "Well, the house might be stripped without his hearing the least noise." "By whom?" "By thieves." "You are a fool, Monsieur Batista. Thieves might strip the house. It would annoy me less than to be disobeyed." Batista bowed. "You understand me," said the Count. "Bring your comrades here, one and all, but let everything remain as usual. Only close the shutters of the ground floor." "And those of the first floor?" "You know they are never closed. Go." The Count signified his intention of dining alone, and that no one but Ali should attend him. Having dined with his usual tranquillity and moderation, the Count, making a signal to Ali to follow him, went out by the side gate, and on reaching the Bois de Boulogne, turned, apparently without design, towards Paris, and at twilight found himself opposite his house in the Champs-Élysées. All was dark. One solitary, feeble light was burning in the porter's lodge, about 40 paces distant from the house, as Batista had said. Monte Cristo leant against a tree, and with that eye which was so rarely deceived, searched the double avenue, examined the passers-by, and carefully looked down the neighbouring streets to see that no one was concealed. 10 minutes passed thus, and he was convinced no one was watching him. He hastened to the side door with Ali, entered precipitately, and by the servant's staircase of which he had the key, gained his bedroom without opening or disarranging a single curtain, without even the porter having the slightest suspicion that the house which he supposed empty contained its chief occupant. Arrived in his bedroom, the Count motioned to Ali to stop. Then he passed into the dressing-room, which he examined. All was as usual. The precious secrétaire in its place, and the key in the secrétaire. He doubly locked it, took the key, returned to the bedroom door, removed the double staple of the bolt, and went in. Meanwhile, Ali had procured the arms the Count required, namely, a short carbine and a pair of double-barreled pistols, with which as sure an aim might be taken as with a single-barreled one. It was about 9:30. The Count and Ali ate in haste a crust of bread and drank a glass of Spanish wine. Then Monte Cristo slipped aside one of the movable panels, which enabled him to see into the adjoining room. He had within his reach his pistols and his carbine, and Ali, standing near him, held one of those small Arabian hatchets whose form has not varied since the Crusades. Through one of the windows of the bedroom, on a line with that in the dressing room, the Count could see into the street. 2 hours passed thus. It was intensely dark. Still, Ali, thanks to his wild nature, and the Count, thanks doubtless to his long confinement, could distinguish in the darkness the slightest movement of the trees. The little light in the lodge had been long extinct. It might be expected that the attack, if indeed an attack was projected, would be made from the staircase of the ground floor, and not from a window. In Monte Cristo's idea, the villains sought his life, not his money. It would be his bedroom they would attack, and they must reach it by the back staircase or by the window in the dressing room. The clock of the Invalides struck 11:45. The west wind bore on its moistened gusts the doleful vibration of the three strokes. As the last stroke died away, the Count thought he heard a slight noise in the dressing room. This first sound, or rather, this first grinding, was followed by a second, then a third. At the fourth, the Count knew what to expect. A firm and well-practiced hand was engaged in cutting the four sides of a pane of glass with a diamond. The Count felt his heart beat more rapidly. He made a sign to apprise Ali, who, understanding that danger was approaching from the other side, drew nearer to his master. Monte Cristo was eager to ascertain the strength and number of his enemies. The window whence the noise proceeded was opposite the opening by which the Count could see into the dressing room. He fixed his eyes on that window. He distinguished a shadow in the darkness. Then one of the panes became quite opaque, as if a sheet of paper were stuck on the outside. Then the square cracked without falling. Through the opening, an arm was passed to find the fastening. A second after, the window turned on its hinges, and a man entered. He was alone. "That's a daring rascal," whispered the Count. At that moment, Ali touched him slightly on the shoulder. He turned. Ali pointed to the window of the room in which they were, facing the street. "Good," said he. "There are two of them. One acts while the other watches." He made a sign to Ali not to lose sight of the man in the street, and returned to the one in the dressing room. The glass cutter had entered and was feeling his way, his arms stretched out before him. At last he appeared to have made himself familiar with all parts. There were two doors. He bolted them both. When he drew near to that of the bedroom, Monte Cristo expected he was coming in and raised one of his pistols, but he simply heard the sound of the bolts sliding in their copper rings. It was only a precaution. The nocturnal visitor, ignorant of the Count's having removed the staples, might now think himself at home and pursue his purpose with full security. Alone and uncontrolled, the man then drew from his pocket something which the Count could not discern, placed it on a stand, then went straight to the secretaire, felt the lock, and, contrary to his expectation, found that the key was missing. But the glass cutter was a prudent man who had provided for all emergencies. The Count soon heard the rattling of a bunch of shapeless keys, such as the locksmith brings when called to force a lock, and which thieves call nightingales, doubtless from the music of their nightly song when they turn the precious lock. "Ah, ah," whispered Monte Cristo with a smile of disappointment. "He is only a thief." But the man in the dark could not find the right key. He reached the instrument he had placed on the stand, touched a spring, and immediately a pale light, just bright enough to render objects distinct, was reflected on the hands and countenance of the man. "Hold!" exclaimed Monte Cristo, starting back. "It is..." Ali raised his hatchet. "Don't stir," whispered Monte Cristo, "and put down your hatchet. We shall require no arms." Then he added some words in a low tone, for the exclamation which surprise had drawn from the count, weak as it had been, had startled the man, who remained in the attitude of an old knife-grinder. It was an order the count had just given, for immediately Ali went noiselessly and returned, bearing a black dress and a three-cornered hat. Meanwhile, Monte Cristo had rapidly taken off his greatcoat, waistcoat, and shirt, and one might distinguish by the glimmering through the opening panel that he wore a pliant tunic of steel mail. This tunic soon disappeared under a long cassock, as did his hair under a priest's wig. The three-cornered hat over this effectually transformed the count into an abbé. The man, hearing nothing more, had again raised himself, and while Monte Cristo was completing his disguise, had advanced straight to the secretaire, whose lock was beginning to crack under his nightingale. "Well done," whispered the count, who depended on the secret spring, which was unknown to the picklock, clever as he might be. "Well done. You have a few minutes' work there." And he advanced to the window. The man whom he had seen seated on a fence had got down and was still pacing the street, but, strange as it appeared, he cared not for those who might pass from the avenue of the Champs-Élysées or by the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. His attention was engrossed with what was passing at the count's, and his only aim appeared to be to discern every movement in the dressing-room. Monte Cristo suddenly struck his finger on his forehead, and a smile passed over his lips. Then, drawing near to Ali, he whispered, "Remain here, concealed in the dark, and whatever noise you hear, whatever passes, only come in or show yourself if I call you." Ali bowed in token of strict obedience. Monte Cristo then drew a lighted taper from a closet, and when the thief was deeply engaged with his lock, silently opened the door, taking care that the light should shine directly on his face. The door opened so quietly that the thief heard no sound, but to his astonishment the room was in a moment light. He turned. "Good evening, dear Monsieur Caderousse," said Monte Cristo. "What are you doing here at such an hour?" "The Abbé Busoni!" exclaimed Caderousse, and, not knowing how this strange apparition could have entered when he had bolted the doors, he let fall his bunch of keys and remained motionless and stupefied. The count placed himself between Caderousse and the window, thus cutting off from the thief his only chance of retreat. "The Abbé Busoni!" repeated Caderousse, fixing his haggard gaze on the count. "Yes, doubtless, the Abbé Busoni himself," replied Monte Cristo, "and I am very glad you recognize me, dear Monsieur Caderousse. It proves you have a good memory, for it must be about 10 years since we last met." This calmness of Busoni, combined with his irony and boldness, staggered Caderousse. "L'Abbé," murmured he, clenching his fists and his teeth chattering. "So, you would rob the Count of Monte Cristo," continued the false abbé. "Monsieur l'Abbé," murmured Caderousse, seeking to regain the window which the count pitilessly intercepted. "Monsieur l'Abbé, I don't know. Believe me, I take my oath." "A pane of glass out," continued the count. "A dark lantern, a bunch of false keys, a secretaire half-forced. It is tolerably evident." Caderousse was choking. He looked round for some corner to hide in, some way of escape. "Come, come," continued the count. "I see you are still the same, an assassin, Monsieur l'Abbé. Since you know everything, you know it was not I. It was La Carconte. That was proved at the trial, since I was only condemned to the galleys." "Is your time then expired, since I find you in a fair way to return there?" "No, Monsieur l'Abbé. I have been liberated by someone."
That someone has done society a great kindness.
Ah, said Caderousse, I had promised,
and you are breaking your promise, interrupted Monte Cristo.
Alas, yes, said Caderousse, very uneasily.
A bad relapse. That will lead you, if I mistake not, to the Place de Grève.
So much the worse. So much the worse, diavolo, as they say in my country. Monsieur l'Abbé, I am impelled. Every criminal says the same thing. Poverty,
pshaw, said Busoni disdainfully. Poverty may make a man beg, steal a loaf of bread at a baker's door, but not cause him to open a secretaire in a house supposed to be inhabited. And when the jeweller Ioannis had just paid you 45,000 francs for the diamond I had given you, and you killed him to get the diamond and the money both, was that also poverty?
Pardon, Monsieur l'Abbé, said Caderousse, you have saved my life once. Save me again.
That is but poor encouragement.
Are you alone, Monsieur l'Abbé, or have you there soldiers ready to seize me?
I am alone, said the abbé, and I will again have pity on you, and will let you escape at the risk of the fresh miseries my weakness may lead to, if you tell me the truth.
Ah, Monsieur l'Abbé, cried Caderousse, clasping his hands and drawing nearer to Monte Cristo, I may indeed say you are my deliverer.
You mean to say you have been freed from confinement?
Yes, in truth, Monsieur l'Abbé.
Who was your liberator?
An Englishman.
What was his name?
Lord Wilmore.
I know him. I shall know if you lie,
Monsieur l'Abbé. I tell you the simple truth.
Was this Englishman protecting you?
No, not me, but a young Corsican, my companion.
What was this young Corsican's name?
Benedetto.
Is that his Christian name?
He had no other. He was a foundling.
Then this young man escaped with you?
He did.
In what way?
We were working at Saint-Mondrier, near Toulon. Do you know Saint-Mondrier?
I do.
In the hour of rest, between noon and 1 o'clock,
galley slaves having a nap after dinner? We may well pity the poor fellows, said the abbé.
Nay, said Caderousse, one can't always work. One is not a dog.
So much the better for the dogs, said Monte Cristo.
While the rest slept, then, we went away a short distance. We severed our fetters with a file the Englishman had given us and swam away.
And what has become of this Benedetto?
I don't know.
You ought to know.
No, in truth, we parted at Ayer.
And to give more weight to his protestation, Caderousse advanced another step towards the abbé, who remained motionless in his place, as calm as ever, and pursuing his interrogation.
You lie, said the abbé Busoni, with a tone of irresistible authority. Monsieur l'abbé, you lie.
This man is still your friend, and you, perhaps, make use of him as your accomplice.
Oh, Monsieur l'Abbé,
since you left Toulon, what have you lived on? Answer me.
On what I could get.
You lie, repeated the Abbé a third time, with a still more imperative tone. Caderousse, terrified, looked at the Count. You have lived on the money he has given you.
True, said Caderousse. Benedetto has become the son of a great lord.
How can he be the son of a great lord?
A natural son.
And what is that great lord's name?
The Count of Monte Cristo, the very same in whose house we are.
Benedetto, the Count's son, replied Monte Cristo, astonished in his turn.
Forsooth, I suppose so, since the Count has found him a false father, since the Count gives him 4,000 francs a month and leaves him 500,000 francs in his will.
Ah, said the false abbé, who began to understand.
And what name does the young man bear, meanwhile?
Andrea Cavalcanti.
Is it, then, that young man whom my friend the Count of Monte Cristo has received into his house, and who is going to marry Mademoiselle Danglars?
Exactly.
And you suffer that, you wretch? You who know his life and his crime?
Why should I stand in a comrade's way? Said Caderousse.
You are right. It is not you who should apprise Monsieur Danglars. It is I.
Do not do so, Monsieur l'Abbé.
Why not?
Because you would bring us to ruin.
And you think that to save such villains as you, I will become an abettor of their plot, an accomplice in their crimes?
Monsieur l'Abbé, said Caderousse, drawing still nearer,
I will expose all to Monsieur Danglars.
By heaven, cried Caderousse, drawing from his waistcoat an open knife and striking the Count in the breast, you shall disclose nothing, l'Abbé.
To Caderousse's great astonishment, the knife, instead of piercing the Count's breast, flew back, blunted. At the same moment, the Count seized with his left hand the assassin's wrist and wrung it with such strength that the knife fell from his stiffened fingers, and Caderousse uttered a cry of pain. But the Count, disregarding his cry, continued to wring the bandit's wrist until, his arm being dislocated, he fell first on his knees, then flat on the floor. The Count then placed his foot on his head, saying, I know not what restrains me from crushing thy skull, rascal.
Oh, mercy, mercy, cried Caderousse.
The Count withdrew his foot.
Rise, said he.
Caderousse rose.
What a wrist you have, Monsieur l'Abbé, said Caderousse, stroking his arm, all bruised by the fleshy pincers which had held it. What a wrist!
Silence! God gives me strength to overcome a wild beast like you. In the name of that God I act. Remember that, wretch, and to spare thee at this moment is still serving him.
Oh, said Caderousse, groaning with pain. Take this pen and paper, and write what I dictate. I don't know how to write, Monsieur l'Abbé. You lie. Take this pen and write.
Caderousse, awed by the superior power of the Abbé, sat down and wrote, Sir, the man whom you are receiving at your house, and to whom you intend to marry your daughter, is a felon who escaped with me from confinement at Toulon. He was number 59, and I number 58. He was called Benedetto, but he is ignorant of his real name, having never known his parents.
Sign it, continued the Count. But would you ruin me?
If I sought your ruin, fool, I should drag you to the first guardhouse. Besides, when that note is delivered, in all probability, you will have no more to fear.
Sign it, then.
Caderousse signed it.
The address. A Monsieur le Baron Danglars, banker, Rue de la Chaussée-d'Antin.
Caderousse wrote the address. The Abbé took the note.
Now, said he, that suffices. Be gone. Which way?
The way you came.
You wish me to get out at that window?
You got in very well.
Oh, you have some design against me, Monsieur l'Abbé.
Idiot, what design can I have?
Why then not let me out by the door?
What would be the advantage of waking the porter?
Monsieur l'Abbé, tell me, do you not wish me dead?
I wish what God wills.
But swear that you will not strike me as I go down. Cowardly fool, what do you intend doing with me?
I ask you, what can I do? I have tried to make you a happy man, and you have turned out a murderer.
Monsieur l'Abbé, said Caderousse, make one more attempt. Try me once more.
I will, said the Count. Listen. You know if I may be relied on.
Yes, said Caderousse.
if you arrive safely at home, what have I to fear, except from you, if you reach your home safely? Leave Paris, leave France, and wherever you may be, so long as you conduct yourself well, I will send you a small annuity. For if you return home safely, then...
Then? Asked Caderousse, shuddering.
Then I shall believe God has forgiven you, and I will forgive you too.
As true as I am a Christian, stammered Caderousse, you will make me die of fright.
Now, be gone, said the Count, pointing to the window. Caderousse, scarcely yet relying on this promise, put his legs out of the window and stood on the ladder. Now go down, said the abbe, folding his arms. Understanding he had nothing more to fear from him, Caderousse began to go down. Then the Count brought the taper to the window, that it might be seen in the Champs-Élysées that a man was getting out of the window while another held a light.
"What are you doing, Monsieur l'Abbé? Suppose a watchman should pass?"
And he blew out the light. He then descended, but it was only when he felt his foot touch the ground that he was satisfied he was safe. Monte Cristo returned to his bedroom, and glancing rapidly from the garden to the street, he saw first Caderousse, who, after walking to the end of the garden, fixed his ladder against the wall at a different part from where he came in. The Count, then looking over into the street, saw the man who appeared to be waiting run in the same direction and place himself against the angle of the wall where Caderousse would come over. Caderousse climbed the ladder slowly and looked over the coping to see if the street was quiet. No one could be seen or heard. The clock of the Invalides struck one. Then Caderousse sat astride the coping and, drawing up his ladder, passed it over the wall, then began to descend, or rather to slide down by the two stanchions, which he did with an ease which proved how accustomed he was to the exercise. But, once started, he could not stop. In vain did he see a man start from the shade when he was halfway down. In vain did he see an arm raised as he touched the ground. Before he could defend himself, that arm struck him so violently in the back that he let go the ladder, crying, "Help!" A second blow struck him almost immediately in the side, and he fell, calling, "Help! Murder!" Then, as he rolled on the ground, his adversary seized him by the hair and struck him a third blow in the chest. This time Caderousse endeavoured to call again, but he could only utter a groan, and he shuddered as the blood flowed from his three wounds. The assassin, finding he no longer cried, lifted his head up by the hair. His eyes were closed and mouth distorted. The murderer, supposing him dead, let fall his head and disappeared. Then Caderousse, feeling that he was leaving him, raised himself on his elbow and with a dying voice cried with great effort,
"Murder! I am dying! Help, Monsieur l'Abbé! Help!"
This mournful appeal pierced the darkness. The door of the back staircase opened, then the side gate of the garden, and Ali and his master were on the spot with lights. 84. The Hand of God. Caderousse continued to call piteously,
"Monsieur l'Abbé, help! Help!"
"What is the matter?" asked Monte Cristo.
"Help!" cried Caderousse. "I am murdered."
"We are here. Take courage."
"Ah, it's all over. You are come too late. You are come to see me die. What blows! What blood!"
He fainted. Ali and his master conveyed the wounded man into a room. Monte Cristo motioned to Ali to undress him, and he then examined his dreadful wounds. "My God," he exclaimed, "thy vengeance is sometimes delayed, but only that it may fall the more effectually." Ali looked at his master for further instructions. "Conduct here immediately the Procureur du Roi, Monsieur de Villefort, who lives in the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. As you pass the lodge, wake the porter and send him for a surgeon."
Ali obeyed, leaving the abbe alone with Caderousse, who had not yet revived. When the wretched man again opened his eyes, the count looked at him with a mournful expression of pity, and his lips moved as if in prayer.
"A surgeon, Monsieur l'Abbé, a surgeon," said Caderousse.
"I have sent for one," replied the abbe.
"I know he cannot save my life, but he may strengthen me to give my evidence."
"Against whom?"
"Against my murderer."
"Did you recognize him?"
"Yes. It was Benedetto."
"The young Corsican?"
"Yes. After giving me the plan of this house, doubtless hoping I should kill the count and he thus become his heir, or that the count would kill me and I should be out of his way, he waylaid me and has murdered me."
"I have also sent for the procureur du roi."
"He will not come in time. I feel my life fast ebbing."
"Stop," said Monte Cristo. He left the room and returned in 5 minutes with a file. The dying man's eyes were all the time riveted on the door through which he hoped succor would arrive.
"Hasten, Monsieur l'Abbé, hasten. I shall faint again."
Monte Cristo approached and dropped on his purple lips 3 or 4 drops of the contents of the phial. Caderousse drew a deep breath.
"Oh," said he, "that is life to me. More, more."
2 drops more would kill you," replied the abbe.
"Oh, send for someone to whom I can denounce the wretch."
"Shall I write your deposition? You can sign it."
"Yes, yes," said Caderousse, and his eyes glistened at the thought of this posthumous revenge.
Monte Cristo wrote, "I die, murdered by the Corsican Benedetto, my comrade in the galleys at Toulouse, number 59.
"Quick, quick," said Caderousse, "or I shall be unable to sign it."
Monte Cristo gave the pen to Caderousse, who collected all his strength, signed it, and fell back on the bed, saying,
"You will relate all the rest, Monsieur l'Abbé. You will say he calls himself Andrea Cavalcanti. He lodges at the Hotel des Princes. Oh, I am dying."
He again fainted. The abbe made him smell the contents of the phial, and he again opened his eyes. His desire for revenge had not forsaken him.
"Ah, you will tell all I have said, will you not, Monsieur l'Abbé?"
"Yes, and much more."
"What more will you say?"
"I will say he had doubtless given you the plan of this house in the hope the count would kill you. I will say, likewise, he had apprised the count by a note of your intention, and the count being absent, I read the note and sat up to await you. I will say that he followed and watched you the whole time, and, when he saw you leave the house, ran to the angle of the wall to conceal himself."
"Did you see all that?"
"Remember my words. If you return home safely, I shall believe God has forgiven you, and I will forgive you also."
"And you did not warn me?" cried Caderousse, raising himself on his elbows. "You knew I should be killed on leaving this house, and did not warn me."
"No, for I saw God's justice placed in the hands of Benedetto, and should have thought it sacrilege to oppose the designs of Providence."
"God's justice? Speak not of it, Monsieur l'Abbé. If God were just, you know many would be punished who now escape."
"Listen," said the abbe, extending his hand over the wounded man as if to command him to believe. "This is what the God in whom on your deathbed you refused to believe has done for you. He gave you health, strength, regular employment, even friends, a life, in fact, which a man might enjoy with a calm conscience. Instead of improving these gifts, rarely granted so abundantly, this has been your course. You have given yourself up to sloth and drunkenness, and, in a fit of intoxication, have ruined your best friend." "Help!" cried Caderousse. "I require a surgeon."